Empower Radio presents The Miracle of Healing with Lisa Campion. Meet healers, learn different modalities, and hear empowering stories of people on their healing journey. The Miracle of Healing on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Lisa Campion.
Hi, I'm Lisa Campion, and this is The Miracle of Healing on Empower Radio, where conscious people come together to explore the world of healing and heal the planet one person at a time. Today we have Danielle Delsky, and I really liked her book. She wrote this book called The Holy Wild, A Heathen Bible for the Untamed Woman. And wow, it is just that. It's kind of a wild book. And Danielle's an artist, yoga teacher, energy worker, founder of the Living Mandala Yoga Teacher Training Programs. And she leads women's circles, witchcraft workshops, energy healing trainings. She's really got a lot going on. And I really liked her book a lot. It was very, very different, very powerful, very stirring. Made me want to rip off all my clothes and run around naked in my garden under the full moon. And I have to tell you, that's not an idea I think about very often. So Danielle, way to go.
Thank you, Lisa. Very happy to be here.
So it's a very unusual book. And I've read a lot of books about witchcraft and sacred divine feminine. And yours is really quite different. It doesn't have like a kind of a manual feeling to it. It's really more of like a, like prayers, rituals that you call verses. I found it very sort of stream of consciousness and kind of hitting the back of my psyche in a powerful way. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to write such an unusual book?
Yeah. So this is my second book. My first book, Woman Most Wild, was kind of an overview of witchcraft. And I guess maybe that one's a little bit more manual-like, but I know what you're talking about, how this one's kind of stream of consciousness. So I look at witchcraft as very much a spiritual practice of poetry, of poetry and beauty. So when I was writing the book, I was thinking about how to present it that way, where the reader could kind of experience what ritual is or what spellcraft or ceremony is in a way that is really meaningful for their own story, instead of it being like a how-to manual or a step-by-step guide on how to cast a circle and things like that. So that was the underlying influence. And also in working with a lot of women over the years, they talk about how when they cast a circle for the first time, or they might do something that's like a more witchcrafty practice that they've never done before. And even though they don't identify as witches, it would feel kind of like a coming home, and they would realize how it met their own story, their own experience. So I was trying to have the book feel that way, like it was coming home, and also poetic and beautiful and not very dogmatic and dry.
Yeah, well, I think it is like poetry. I really enjoyed it, and I could feel like I love poetry. And it's sort of hard to find, these days. It's sort of fallen out of favor, which is sad to me. But I found it like when I said sort of hitting my psyche in a particular way, that I feel like is what a lot of us are missing in the world, and when we're called to do ritual work, we're often accessing or feeding this part of our being that doesn't get really fed in our normal day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. And we need our rituals and our ceremonies to speak to, in fairy tradition, they call it the young self, which is, means they have to be a little bit joyous and fun and beautiful and kind of like art. So when they become really rote and kind of mundane, it's a bummer. And it's what sends a lot of people away from witchcraft before they really get started. So it's important to have that kind of lighthearted and artistic element to ritual and ceremony and spellcraft. Sure.
I love it that you called it a heathen Bible, because it just seems like it's such an oxymoron, and yet I had that sense in a way of like reading like powerful scripture, but totally off the charts, like nothing else. How did you come up with that concept of the heathen Bible? It was awesome.
Well, I totally fought for it because it was, you know, it was something that was feared, like maybe not particularly marketable or scary.
Yeah, scary, your publisher even gave you a little bit of a hassle about it.
A little bit.
Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, heathen is such a great word, and it's something that my mother used to call me when I was younger, when I was doing something that wasn't particularly godly or Christian-like. So I've always been kind of intrigued by that word, but the etymology just means dweller on the heath or inhabiting uncultivated land. So it kind of, just like pagan, it harkens back to the old ways and spiritual practices that predate our formalized religions. So, you know, heathen is this really great word where it's like, we can still be spiritual. We can strip down everything that we think we know about religion and spirituality and all of the philosophy and all of the maybe reading that we've done, and just get back to the basics, get back to nature and the wild. So yeah, and then Bible, I mean, that just means book. The etymology just means book. But the idea is that, you know, there's all of these opportunities in the holy wild for the reader to kind of write their own story or look at where the verses meet their own experience. So when we think of Bible, we think of a sacred book, but my message is that every woman's story is sacred and holy. So it's not that, you know, I as the author am writing these words that I'm going to call holy. It's more that the reader is going to read these words, and wherever they meet their own experience, that's what's sacred and divine.
I like that about your book right away. It's like right in the beginning, you're very inclusive, you know, and very, you know, non-hierarchical, I'm not better than you. I'm just, you know,
right.
We're all trying to figure this out together. And that, I think that's a really, I don't know, there's a lot of love in the way that you write. So I think people that read it will feel like you're their friend, and you're talking to them directly and sort of encouraging them to live from this holy wild. And I'm wondering if you could also talk more about the holy wild, which also has such a beautiful, powerful ring to it. What do you mean by the holy wild?
Yeah. So holy, just like sacred. And like I was saying, you know, just this idea that every human experience is holy and sacred, and that we don't have to look to an external deity or any external forces that might seem superior or present themselves as other than us, that really it's an embodied sense of the divine. So holy in that way. And then wild, meaning not only nature, but also the way our own experience meets nature. So the way we receive the seasons or the solar cycles and also the lunar cycles, the way we meet the elements at different points in our lives, and also letting those things change. So like if we wake up one morning and we don't necessarily feel like doing the full moon ritual, even though it's a full moon, but that doesn't mean that, you know, oh, this practice isn't for me, or I should obviously go back to church or whatever, that it's just, you know, our spirituality cycles just like every other part of our psyche does. So if we wake up and we're in kind of a waning spirituality time, that's totally fine. Just like, you know, nature drops the trees drop their leaves now at autumn. You know, it's normal for our spirituality to cycle just like the wild does. So it's primal in that way. But it also distinguishes it from non-earth-based traditions, I think.
Well, I love that you call all, it's sort of like you have this assumption that all women are wild women. And I consider myself somewhat of a wild woman, because I'm like, I'm a psychic. I'm a little out of the box. I've got a good amount of tattoos. Like, I'm like not, you know, kind of an in the box person. And yet today I was at Ann Taylor buying a suit so I can be on TV, because I have a TV thing I've got to do. And I'm like, wow, like, you know, How do we hold on to our wildness as women when we have to be at Ann Taylor buying a suit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I had a similar experience not that long ago. I think that it's it's important to look at our wildness as being completely internal. So when I talk about like the untamed woman and what does that look like? Well, it looks all sorts of different ways, but it's how does it feel, right? So I think you can totally be an Ann Taylor buying a suit and be just as wild as, like you said, when you're dancing in your garden naked under the full moon. It's mostly about, you know, stripping away our own indoctrinated beliefs about what is wild and what isn't, and not so much about these the kind of external perceptions about what wildness looks like, because I think it's different for everybody.
Yeah. And how do we do that? Like, how do we really hold on to the wildness, like sort of again, like when we're so, you know, called upon by family, career, you know, there's sort of this ever-present pressure to get back in the box, you know, Like how do we hold on to the wild?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can only speak from my own experience, and it's this constant, if not tireless, introspection and self-examination about, you know, why am I really doing this? You know, so if I'm in Ann Taylor buying a suit, it's like, well, what's under this? And then what's under that feeling? What's under that? And I do that a lot. And I don't know if it's a little bit pathological or not, but I'm always kind of doing this check-in, like, is this really me? Is this really making me feel the most me I can possibly feel right now? Because that's what wildness is to me. It's being as authentic as possible all the time.
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
Regardless
of what the environment looks like.
That makes sense to me, because it's really an internal thing. Like, you know, we have to do what we have to do, or what we choose to do, right? Might be that, you know, more straight-laced or more fitting in, and whatever we choose to do, we have, sometimes that's to our benefit. But I love it that it's an internal wildness, of the wildness of being authentic. That was awesome.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what it is for me anyway. I guess it might be different for other people.
You think that there's sort of like a push now to sort of really reclaim the divine feminine? Do you think there's coming to a head, and why now, if that's true?
It's interesting. I have lots to say about that. I think that, you know, there's coming home to the divine feminine, there's this idea of resurrecting the goddess, and both of those things are certainly so important, and particularly right now in the socio-political climate when there's all of this, you know, feminine rage. But I think that there has been this desire for what I call the palatable goddess. So kind of looking for goddess that's maybe like kind of pink and fluffy and safe, because it feels like, well, maybe that's not evil or something like that. And I do think it gets back to our indoctrinated beliefs from childhood, when really what's needed, and I think right now especially what's rising, is the goddess of destruction, which is her darker face, which is this idea that, you know, there is this feminine wildness that wants to just completely dismantle all of these systems that don't serve us. And it's not pretty. And it is, you know, the hag or the crone face that we get in our fairy tales or our movies. And that, you know, that's really what's needed. So there's kind of this very organic rising of that feminine destructive force right now that I think is maybe not necessarily what people were looking for, but it's definitely,
I mean,
what's happening.
Like, you know, the goddess is sort of like, she, you know, she's not like the Playboy bunny. It's not the Playboy bunny version of the goddess, you know, or the Victoria's Secret, you know, god, it's like Kali, you know, like that
right.
the rage, the anger, the power of destruction, and that's so interesting, isn't it, that it's,
yeah, and in traditions that not, you know, Western patriarchal religions, but traditions that do have feminine deities and goddesses, there is this notion that you have to meet her destructive face first if you're to meet her at all, that you can't kind of look for her soft and safe face because it's not real, it'll just be an illusion. And I always love that idea that we have to meet this, we have to meet her, capital H, as like the breakdown first, and then we get to meet her kind of softer, more grandmotherly side.
Cool. So I liked how your book sort of laid out in terms of like the book, the elements. So you have the book of earth, the book of water, and fire, air, and ether. It's a very cool way to organize it. Can you tell us a little bit about what those mean?
So the whole book is kind of segmented into these five different books according to the elements. And then each of those books is divided into three different chapters. And those chapters are verses, rituals, and magic. So for each element, there's these verses chapters that are like the poetry that we were talking about, and then also opportunities for the reader to kind of write their own story using the prompts that I offer, in order to see, you know, how does this element really relate to my own story, as if my story were, first of all, important, because it is important, but then also as like this epic myth. So even kind of amplify the idea that your story is important and frame it as like the greatest story ever told. And then the rituals chapters are spellcraft and the different ceremonies that the reader could do to develop a more personal relationship with the element. And then finally, the magic chapters are like guided meditations and additional verses and poetry for going even deeper. So that's how the book's organized. And then, you know, the elements are just my lens of how I look at the world and how I have for years. So it's framing all of the elements in terms of not only witchcraft, but also the chakra system and, you know, body prayer, movement, and also art and writing. So there's all of these different elements in there that help to kind of facilitate, I hope, the reader's own personal development of their craft.
That's cool. And I think the elements are really powerful to work with. And even, you know, things like feng shui, I mean, there's so many in shamanism and, you know, sort of very across the world in a way. Like that's a powerful system to look at how to bring balance into our life. If we spend a little time with each element, we can, do you find that people have like one or two elements that they're really already aligned with?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And that's actually what I tell people when they're kind of drawn to this work, but they're not sure where to start is, you know, you look at those moments in your own experience from childhood. And then as you get older, those moments in nature when you really felt really whole and present and completely in the moment. And then what elements were present, right? So for some people, it's staring at a campfire or watching the sunrise. So that's obviously fire. For other people, it'll be swimming in the ocean and it's water. And you do, when you track all of these different moments of presence and being, you do get themes and you can see, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm very drawn to earth and water. Or I'm very drawn to fire and air. And then that very much should be a key shaper of your craft in order to make your witchcraft that much more authentic and personally meaningful to you.
Interesting. I think like the other elements, like, you know, we might have to court them. Like if they're not in our natural alignment, we have to bring them into our life in order to find balance.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I think, you know, right now there's so much feminine rage in the climate that a lot of women just feel like they're fire. like I am only fire. And it's important that you do cultivate ether and you rest in those moments of like, you know, potent rage. Because, you know, fire can only burn for so long before it burns out. So yeah, absolutely. It's about balance. Very much so.
And can you talk a little bit about like magic with a K? Like what is that? I mean, magic with a C, like in my mind, magic with a C is like like illusionism, you know, like what you see like stage magicians do, and magic with a K is like the real, you know, learning how to shape our reality by using these tools that you talk about in your book. But tell me what does it mean to you? What does it mean to a witch?
Yeah. Well, that was a great description. I mean, the magic with a K, that was Gerald Gardner formalized that just in order to distinguish between our magic and then the magic that magicians work, which is illusion, or sleight of hand, right? So the idea of like, what is this real magic with a K? Every witch would probably give you a different answer. For me, it's fundamentally about two different pieces that are both key. And the first is acknowledging as the practitioner of magic that you're made of the same stuff, whether you call it the elements or you call it, you know, the cosmic spark or prana or chi or whatever you want to call it. You're made of that same force that the cosmic web is made out of. So when you're trying to affect change through your magic in the world, it's not about you as the center point kind of sending these ripples out and hoping for the best. It's you saying, I'm made of the same stuff as these ethers that I'm trying to affect change in. And so it's not an internal reality affecting an external. It's just sending ripples through one fabric, if that makes sense. And then the other piece of it is that your magic is always a conversation with the universe about the kind of world you hope the children of the future will live in. So your spellcraft always has to have these deep core values infused into it. So you couldn't just call in, you know, $1 million for yourself without linking that to your deep values and also, you know, the abundance that you want for the global community or some way to make it bigger than you, because it is bigger than you. So magic doesn't begin and end with a single practitioner. It's all about this connection between the witch or the practitioner of magic and what is greater than they are.
Well, I live here in Massachusetts, and my daughter goes to Salem State University in Salem, Massachusetts, where there's been a lot of famous witches. And I'm up there a lot visiting her, and it's crazy up there right about now with the, you know, the visitors and the tourists and the witches. And it's really like sort of a funny, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a funny feeling because it's like on some way honoring the craft and honoring the history of that. And it in other ways, sort of exploitive, I find in a kind of difficult, well, it's difficult to watch and the expectation of that for me. But tell me, like, what about, like, you know, the bad side of witches, or what, how do you be a witch in the world? I guess that's what I want to know. How do you be a witch in the world and deal with all of that?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I think that, you know, there are bad witches because there's bad people, right? So it's not the magic that's bad.
They're bad psychics too.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing, right? So it's not the psychic worker, the magic that's bad. It's that, you know, it's the practitioner. And I guess, you know, I'll go back to what I said right in the beginning, where it's just about, you know, being as authentic as possible. And I think that when people take it in, you know, a more marketable direction, maybe, or more exploitative, that's inauthentic. And I do think that people see that. I mean, just like when you go to Salem and you see that, I do think people notice, you know, and then it's a matter of, do they care if people see it as kind of fake and more fluffy, but they're making money, then maybe they don't care that's the way it's being presented. You know, so I guess for me, it's always just, am I being genuine? Am I being authentic? And I can't really control what other people do as much as
God knows. I totally get it. It's the same thing for us psychics. You know, there's some really excellent ones, there's some middle of the road ones, and there's a whole bunch of them giving the rest of us a bad name, but it's just the way we roll, I guess. But how can people get in touch with you, Danielle, if they want to learn more, find your other book, study with you, because I know you offer classes? How can people get in touch with you?
So the best way is probably my website, which is just my name. So Danielle, D-A-N-I-E-L-L-E. Dulsky, Dulsky.com. And everything is on there that I do, from trainings to online offerings. And then I have articles on there and also a list of the different workshops that I'm doing, and book signings and stuff like that throughout the autumn. So I think website's probably the best way.
Good.
The book is on Amazon and bookstores and all of that.
And I totally encourage people to read your books. I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it quite a lot. And thank you so much for being on the show with me today. It was lovely to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. Very happy to be here.
And thanks for all of you guys for joining me today on The Miracle of Healing, where we are healing the planet one person at a time, right here on Empower Radio.